Okay, let's unpack this. You ever stop and think about how two families pulling in the exact same total income can end up with, well, drastically different tax bills?
It happens all the time. It might seem a bit strange, but it often comes down to something called income splitting.
Right, income splitting. That's the fascinating territory we're exploring today.
And what's really fascinating is how Canada's progressive tax system kind of sets the stage for this because, those higher income levels, they face steeper tax rates.
Exactly. So strategically shifting income within a family to members in lower brackets, that can really change the overall tax picture.
It's basically about, well, leveraging the system as it stands, understanding how it works.
Yeah. Think back to that basic idea. We all know higher income, higher tax rate. Income splitting is really a set of strategies to sort of deal with that. So our mission in this deep dive is to cut through the noise, really get to the core of income splitting. Why it matters for Canadian families trying to, minimize their tax burden, and how to navigate the key rules.
And do it legitimately.
Critically, we're not talking about aggressive tax avoidance here. Definitely not chasing loopholes. It's about understanding and legally using the tools, based on government info and, clear explanations of these often tricky tax rules.
It's about being informed, right? So you can make smart choices, but like you said, while a lower tax bill sounds great, this isn't the Wild West.
Not at all.
Income splitting in Canada, yeah, it's legal when done right, but it's definitely an area that Canada Revenue Agency, the CRA, keeps a close eye on through the Income Tax Act.
And this is where it gets really interesting. The CRA has put up some pretty significant guardrails. Things like the attribution rules and the tax on split income or TOSI.
Right. These are basically there to stop what the CRA sees as, let's say, artificial tax move strategies that don't really have an economic reason beyond just cutting the tax bill.
Makes sense.
So think of the attribution rules as the CRA saying, look, what's yours? It's still yours for tax purposes, even if you like give it away to family, unless you follow very specific conditions.
Yeah. The main idea is to stop people from just shifting investment income or capital gains by, say, gifting property or giving low-interest loans to a spouse or a minor child.
Right. So if I decide to gift some shares to my spouse who's in a lower tax bracket, does that mean the dividends and capital gains they make are automatically taxed at their lower rate? It's not quite that simple, is it?
Not usually, no. Under those attribution rules, that income or those capital gains would generally be attributed back to you, the original owner, and taxed at your higher rate. That's a really key point for spouses or common law partners.
Okay, building on that. What if I gift money to my young child, say under 18, and they invest it? How does that work?
With minor children under 18, it's a bit different. Any income generated from those gifted funds, think interest, dividends that would typically attribute back to you, the parent.
Yeah.
But, and this is the interesting part, any capital gains realized on those investments, they're usually taxed in the child's hands.
So there's a distinction there. A crucial one, yeah, between income and capital gains for minors. Something listeners need to grasp when thinking about family investments.
Okay. Interesting. And once the kids hit 18, are we generally in the clear with just outright gifts then?
Generally, yes. Once a child becomes an adult, usually no attribution on outright gifts. However,
Always a however in tax, isn't there?
pretty much, if you give a low or no interest loan to an adult child and the CRA figures out that a key reason for that loan was just to cut taxes, then the income, but usually not the capital gains from those funds, might still be attributed back to you.
Wow. Okay, so just gifting assets purely to shift investment income. Sounds like that's likely to get flagged. But are there, legitimate ways to lend or give money without these attribution rules kicking in?
Oh, absolutely. There are important exceptions. One really significant one is the prescribed rate loan.
Okay, I've heard of that. How does it work?
Well, it involves lending funds, say, to a lower income spouse, an adult child, or even a family trust. But, and this is key, it comes with very specific strings attached. The loan must be made at the CRA's prescribed interest rate.
Which they set quarterly, right?
Exactly, set when the loan starts. And it's not just a set it and forget it thing.
Ah, okay. They're ongoing obligations.
You bet. The borrower absolutely must pay the interest back to the lender by January 30th of the following year. Every year.
And if they miss that deadline, even once.
Uh-oh. If that annual interest payment isn't made on time, the whole strategy can basically be thrown out. Invalid. The attribution rules could then apply retroactively. I've seen plans fall apart over that missed deadline.
Yikes. So mark January 30th in bold on the calendar.
Definitely. The real insight here isn't just about maybe getting a low rate. It's that the future investment growth can be taxed at a potentially much lower rate within the family. But sticking to the rules, non-negotiable.
Okay, January 30th, critical. What other exceptions should we know about? Any other ways around attribution?
Yeah, another key one is a fair market value sale. If you sell an asset to a family member for what it's actually worth, its true market value, then attribution generally won't apply. Because, well, there's no gift or low-interest loan involved.
It makes sense. It's a real transaction.
Exactly. Also, there's something called income on income that's usually not attributed again.
Meaning?
So let's say some investment income was already attributed back to you last year. If you then reinvest that attributed income, any new income earned on that reinvested amount, typically it isn't attributed back to you a second time.
Okay.
But you need meticulous records here. You have to be able to track and prove where the income came from.
Right. Paperwork is king. What about contributing to a tax-free savings account, TFSA, for a spouse? Does attribution apply there?
That's a smart question. Gifting funds to your spouse specifically so they can put it in their own TFSA, that does not trigger attribution on the income earned inside their TFSA. That growth stays tax-free for them, as intended. And finally, just remember these attribution rules. They mainly target investment income and capital gains, not usually income from, like, actively running a business.
Got it. Okay, so that helps clarify the attribution rules. Right. Now let's tackle the other big one you mentioned. The tax on split income, or TOSI. Sounds like it's aimed at something specific.
It really is. TOSI, which got a major expansion back in 2018, is specifically designed to stop what's often called income sprinkling.
Income sprinkling.
Yeah, within a private related business. The issue is when income, think dividends, maybe interest, certain capital gains gets paid out from the business to family members who haven't, you know, reasonably contributed to earning it.
So the idea behind the rules is to show real economic activity, real contribution, not just moving income on paper.
Precisely.
So if I own a business and I pay dividends to my spouse or my adult kids, but they don't actually work much in the business, that could be flagged as split income.
That's exactly the kind of scenario TOSI targets. And if TOSI applies, that split income gets taxed at the highest federal rate, currently 33%.
How? 33%?
Plus, the person receiving it faces limits on claiming certain tax credits. There's even a specific form, T-1206, for reporting it. The core issue TOSI attacks is paying income that seems unreasonable compared to what the recipient actually did their work, capital contributed, risks taken in the business.
Right. The CRA wants the business income taxed with those genuinely earning it or taking the risk.
Mm-hmm.
But just like attribution, I'm guessing there are situations where payments are okay, where TOSI doesn't apply.
You're right. There are several key exclusions, thankfully, offering legitimate paths for business owners. One big one is the excluded business rule.
Excluded business?
Yeah. If the family member getting the income is 18 or older, and they've worked, on average, at least 20 hours a week in the business, either now or in any five previous years, then the income they receive might be excluded from TOSI.
20 hours a week, okay.
It really highlights the need for, you know, provable active involvement.
So if my adult child has genuinely put in the hours at my business for years, the dividends they get might be fine under this rule.
Potentially, yes. Another factor is the ownership structure itself. There's the excluded shares rule.
How does that work?
Well, if the recipient is 25 or older, and they own shares that represent at least 10% of the votes and value of certain types of corporations, usually not service or professional ones, then income from those shares might also be excluded.
So 10% votes and value.
Right. It's seen as an indicator that they have a real stake, real influence, not just passively receiving income.
Okay, so active work or significant ownership can get you an exclusion. What if someone doesn't quite meet those hours or the 10% ownership test, but they do contribute meaningfully?
Ah, that brings us to the reasonable return exclusion. But how it applies depends on age.
Okay.
For people 25 and older, if the income they get from the business is considered reasonable based on their work, property contributed, or risks they took on, then TOSI might not apply.
But reasonable sounds a bit subjective.
It can be. You definitely need to be prepared to justify the amounts paid. Documentation again.
Naturally. And for the younger ones, say 18 to 24, is there a similar reasonable return test?
Yes, but it's generally stricter for that age group.
Mm-hmm.
The income needs to be reasonable based on their specific contributions, or there's a more defined safe harbor calculation based on a return on capital they personally contributed to the business.
Gotcha. Stricter for 18, 24. What about the spouse of the business owner, especially if they're, say, nearing retirement and maybe contributed a lot over the years?
Good question. There's a specific exclusion for the spouse of a business owner who is 65 or older. If the main business owner is also 65 plus and the spouse made meaningful contributions over the business's history, then income the spouse receives might be excluded from TOSI.
Okay, those are helpful distinctions. Are there other types of income from business that generally just fall outside TOSI altogether?
Yes. Regular salaries or wages paid to family members usually aren't TOSI, provided they're reasonable for the actual work done. We'll come back to that.
Right.
Also, certain capital gains, like from selling qualified small business corporation shares, are often excluded. And things like inheritances or payments from a marriage breakdown, like separation payments, those aren't subject to TOSI either.
So TOSI is a big deal for business income sprinkling.
Yeah.
But there are important carve-outs for legitimate situations.
Exactly.
So boiling it down, it feels like the key difference is attribution looks mostly at the type of income, like investments and how the assets moved. TOSI is more about the source or related business and whether payments to family are justified by their contribution. Is that fair?
That's a very insightful way to sum it up, actually. So now that we've hopefully got a better handle on these main rules, maybe we can pivot. Let's talk about some concrete strategies families can explore, you know, within these boundaries.
Yes. Okay. This is where we get into actionable stuff listeners can consider. What are some well-established CRA-accepted ways to split income?
Well, one of the most common and relatively straightforward is pension income splitting. If you're married or common law, the spouse with the higher income can choose to allocate up to 50% of their eligible pension income to the lower income spouse. It happens right on the tax return.
And crucially, no actual money changes hands.
Exactly. It's purely a tax allocation, done using Form T2 and Euro 32.
Okay, but what counts as eligible pension income for this? Is it just any pension?
It depends on the age of the person receiving the pension income. If they're 65 or older, it's pretty broad. Payments from a registered pension plan, an RPP, withdrawals from a RIF, registered retirement income fund, or a life income fund.
Okay, 65 plus is broader. What about under 65?
More restricted then. Primarily, it's lifetime annuity payments from an RPP. Regular RRSP withdrawals, generally not eligible.
But RRIF withdrawals are okay after 65.
Yes, RRIF withdrawals become eligible for splitting once you hit 65. That's a key planning point.
Good to know. What about government benefits, like Canada Pension Plan or Old Age Security? Can you split those?
Nope, those are specifically excluded. So CPP, QPP, OAS, and the Guaranteed Income Supplement, GIS, along with lump sum RRSP withdrawals, none of those qualify for this type of pension income splitting.
Got it. So who really benefits most from this pension splitting strategy?
It can offer several nice advantages. Obviously, it lowers the total family tax bill by shifting income to a lower bracket.
Right.
It can also potentially reduce OAS clawback for the higher income spouse since their net income for OAS calculation is lower.
The clawback. Good point.
Plus, it might let both spouses claim the pension income tax credit. And as we mentioned, being able to convert RSPs to RRFs at 65 makes the strategy more accessible for many.
Okay, that's pension splitting. Another one that comes up all the time is spousal RRSPs. How do they fit into income splitting?
Spousal RRSPs are a classic strategy. The higher income spouse contributes to an RRSP that's legally owned by the lower income spouse.
But the contributor gets the tax deduction now.
That's right. The contributor gets the immediate tax break. But then, way down the road, when the funds are withdrawn in retirement, they're taxed in the hands of the owner spouse, the annuitant, ideally when they're in a lower tax bracket.
So it splits income in retirement.
Exactly. Potentially even before age 65. It can also be a way to shift more than just 50% of retirement savings towards the lower income spouse, and again, helps manage potential OAS clawback later on.
But there's a catch, isn't there?
Yeah.
Something about withdrawing the money too soon.
Yes, a very important catch. The attribution rule applies here too. If the lower income spouse pulls money out within 3 years, that's the year of withdrawal, plus the two prior calendar years of a contribution being made by the higher income spouse.
Then what?
Then those withdrawn amounts might get taxed back in the hands of the contributing spouse. There's a form for this, T2205.
So you can't just contribute this year and have your spouse take it out next year at their lower rate.
Definitely not. Careful planning around timing contributions and withdrawals is absolutely essential. It's meant as a long-term retirement income splitting tool, not a quick tax dodge.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, we talked about prescribed rate loans before with attribution rules. Let's look at them specifically as a strategy people might use.
Right. Prescribed rate loans can be very effective for splitting investment income. The higher income person lends money to a lower income spouse, adult child, or a family trust.
At that special CRA rate.
At the CRA's prescribed rate or higher, yes. The borrower invests the money and then any net investment income. So after paying the loan interest, it's taxed in their hands at their lower rate.
So the benefit is that the future growth gets taxed lower while the loan itself is still an asset of the lender.
Precisely. But again, the conditions are super strict. Got to have that written loan agreement, got to use the right rate when the loan starts, and absolutely, critically, the borrower must pay the interest by January 30th each year.
We keep coming back to that January 30th deadline.
Because it's fatal if you miss it. Miss one payment, the strategy is toast, retroactively and going forward. Attribution rules could kick right back in.
Okay, duly noted.
But if you follow all the rules diligently, it can be a powerful way to sidestep attribution on that net investment income. And bonus, that initial prescribed rate is locked in for the whole loan term.
Locked in. Interesting. Okay, shifting to business owners again. Another potential strategy, keeping TOSI in mind, is paying salaries to family members.
Yes. If family members genuinely do work for the business, paying them a reasonable salary is a legitimate business expense. It's deductible for the company, taxable income for the family member, and salaries themselves, generally not subject to TOSI.
Okay, but that word reasonable seems like the absolute key here.
Yeah.
How does the CRA judge reasonableness?
It's paramount. The salary you pay a family member has to be comparable to what you'd pay a stranger, an arm's length purser, for the exact same job.
So you look at their duties, hours, skills, experience.
And what the market rate is for similar jobs in your industry and area. Absolutely.
So you can't just, I don't know, pay your spouse $100,000 if they only pop in occasionally to answer the phone.
Exactly right. And documentation is vital. You need a clear job description, maybe timesheets, an employment contract, proof the payments were actually made, everything to back up the reasonableness.
And if the CRA decides it's not reasonable?
Big problem. They could deny the deduction for the business, but the recipient might still be taxed on the full amount they received. That's double taxation. Very bad.
Ouch.
And don't forget, standard payroll stuff applies too. T4s, withholdings for tax, CPP, EI, all that jazz.
Right. Okay, let's switch gears a bit. There's another government program, isn't there, that helps with sharing income in retirement. CPP pension sharing.
Yes, that's a valuable one for eligible spouses or common law partners. Both need to be at least 60, and both need to be receiving or have applied for their CPP retirement pensions.
And how does it work? Do they just split the payments 50-50?
Not automatically 50-50. They apply to Service Canada, and the sharing is based on the number of months they lived together while both were contributing to CPP. Okay.
Service Canada then adjusts the monthly payments.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the higher earner's CPP goes down a bit, the lower earner's goes up a bit. The total combined CPP amount the couple receives stays the same.
So it's more about evening out the individual payments, likely for tax reasons.
Precisely. It helps shift some taxable income to the lower income spouse, but you have to apply using form ISP 1002. It's not automatic.
And is it always beneficial?
Not necessarily. The calculation is complex, so it's usually smart to figure out the potential benefit before applying, and it stops automatically if one spouse dies or upon divorce or separation.
Good to know. Okay, we've covered several major strategies. Are there any others worth mentioning? Maybe ones that are a bit more complex or niche?
Yeah, a few others we can touch on briefly. Family trusts come up. If they're funded properly, maybe with prescribed rate loans, they can be used to allocate investment income among beneficiaries. But they usually involve hefty setup costs and ongoing admin. Definitely need professional help there.
Right, trusts aren't simple. We mentioned TFSA giving funds for a spouse's TFSA means no attribution on that tax-free growth. Simple, effective.
That's a good one.
Even just strategically paying household expenses can help indirectly. If the higher earner covers more bills, it frees up the lower earner's income for their own investments, avoiding attribution. But keep good records of who pays what.
Makes sense.
RESPs, Registered Education Savings Plans, they shift investment growth and grants to be taxed later in the student's hands, usually at a lower rate. And finally, just outright gifting capital assets to adult children can shift the future capital gains tax liability to them.
Okay, lots of options there, some simply than others. So we've looked at legitimate ways. Now, the flip side, what are the things that can really get people into trouble with the CRA? What should folks absolutely avoid?
Well, number one is probably just ignoring the attribution rules in TOSI. We've hammered this home, but trying to shift passive income by gifting or lending without meeting the specific exceptions, like prescribed rate loans, high risk.
And paying dividends subject to TOSI without meeting an exclusion.
Huge red flag. That's exactly what TOSI is designed to stop.
And we mentioned it before, but it bears repeating. Paying unreasonable salaries to family.
Absolutely. Paying way more than fair market value for the work done, the deduction will likely be denied and you could face that double tax hit. Major danger zone.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Beyond specific rules, people need to be wary of artificial transactions and the big hammer, the general anti-avoidance rule, or GAAR.
GAAR. Sounds ominous.
It can be. Even if a strategy seems to technically follow the letter of the Income Tax Act, if the CRA decides its main purpose was just tax avoidance and it misuses or abuses the spirit of the act, they can use GAR to deny the tax benefit.
So even if it looks legal on paper.
Yeah. Especially really complex, contrived plans that don't seem to have any real economic substance beyond saving tax. If it feels overly complicated or, frankly, too good to be true, that's a sign to be very cautious and get expert advice.
Right. If it smells fishy. So, key takeaway. Overly complex stuff, just to sidestep tax in a way that feels off. Probably is off. Now, for our listener trying to process all this, what are the key takeaways? What should they really keep in mind?
Okay, first and foremost, document everything meticulously. Prescribed rate loans, keep the agreement, proof of every interest payment, salaries, job descriptions, timesheets, market comparisons, TOSI exclusions, records proving active involvement or whatever exclusion applies, the burden of proof. It's always on you, the taxpayer.
Right. Paperwork, paperwork, paperwork. It might not be exciting, but sounds absolutely critical here. What else?
Know the risks. Seriously, getting it wrong can mean reassessments, interest piling up, major penalties, sometimes even gross negligence penalties if it looks like intentional avoidance.
And a CRA does audit this stuff.
Oh, yeah. They actively look at areas they see as high risk, like family business transactions. Also, maybe be aware of the Voluntary Disclosures Program, the VDP. If you realize you made a past mistake, it might be an option to come forward proactively.
And I think we'd both agree, don't try to DIY this complex stuff.
Absolutely not. Get professional advice. Seriously. Talk to a qualified CPA or a tax lawyer. They can look at your specific situation, help pick the right strategies, structure them correctly, explain the real risks, including GAR, and keep you compliant as laws change. It's worth the investment.
Definitely. And remember, we've mostly taught federal rules. Provincial taxes matter too, right?
That's right. Consider provincial taxes. The actual savings depend on your combined federal and provincial rates. And some rules, like pension splitting, might have slight provincial variations. Quebec, for instance, can differ.
Good point. Finally, it sounds like income splitting isn't a set it and forget it deal.
Not at all. Review your strategies regularly. Tax laws change, prescribed rates change, your family situation changes, your income changes. You need to periodically check in with your advisor to make sure your strategies are still effective and, crucially, still compliant. And yeah, be ready for the ongoing admin work some strategies require.
Okay, so let's try to wrap this up. Income splitting in Canada, it can be a really valuable tool, a legitimate way to lower your family's overall tax bill. But
as we've gone through today, it is definitely not simple. You need a solid grasp of some pretty complex rules, attribution, and TOSI especially. And it demands careful planning, meticulous execution, staying on the right side of the line.
Exactly. It's really about knowing the difference between legitimate strategies, pension splitting, spousal RRSPs, properly done prescribed rate loans, reasonable salaries, and those things that cross into aggressive avoidance and could bring trouble.
Well said.
Okay, so here's a final thought for you, our listener, to chew on. Thinking about everything we've discussed in this deep dive, which of these income splitting ideas might actually apply to your family's situation? And maybe more importantly, what specific questions do you have now for a professional advisor?
Yeah, use this as a starting point for that conversation.
Absolutely. Talk to a qualified expert to explore your options thoroughly. And always remember, proactive informed planning done correctly and legally, that's really the best path to, potentially and effectively, reducing your family's tax burden.